Listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network, broadcasting on satellite GE1, Transponder 7, 7.56 audio, and over 700 FM stations across the nation and around the world. The Hour of the Time is also carried on WRMI, Worldwide Shortwave Radio, 9955 kHz, Monday through Friday nights, 5 until 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
This is my daddy's station. I'm Pooh, classic radio like you always wished it could be. 101.1 FM, Eager.
101.1 FM is owned and operated by the Independence Foundation Trust as a non-profit community service.
You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. The man William Jefferson Clinton named as the most dangerous radio host in America. And if you continue to listen to this broadcast, you'll find out why. We wield the sword of truth here. And socialism cannot stand it, for it is built upon a mountain of lies. Please note the following schedule changes for the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network programming. All times are Eastern Standard Time. Monday through Friday, 5 until 7 p.m., the Hour of the Time, with yours truly, William Cooper. Monday and Tuesday nights, 9 to 10 p.m., Quest for Health with Michael Cottingham. Thursday nights, 9 till 11 p.m., Home Satellite Radio Show with Dan Morgan. Friday nights, 5 until 7 p.m., 9 until 11 p.m., Friday Night Live with Gary Bourgeois. And Saturday night, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m., American Exposé with Chris Gerner. And beginning this Sunday, for all of you affiliate stations and anybody else who's interested, we will beginning Sunday, start airing additional programming on the network with the phone funds, the contributions of the listening audience that you've all been waiting for. And we've already aired quite a few, and I think most of you caught those. And we will begin this Sunday, airing again. It will begin at noon, 12 noon Mountain Standard Time. That means 2 o'clock Central, 3 o'clock Eastern, and 12 noon Pacific, because we don't go on daylight saving time, folks. So that's why the strange times there. Also, I will be speaking in Porterville, California, Saturday, April the 26th, 1997. I will be giving a six-hour lecture in tents. Don't even think of showing up, folks, without a tape recorder or a thick pad of paper and a pen. No video camcorders will be allowed under any circumstances whatsoever, so don't even try it. The admission is $10 per person. For more information, call Doyle Shamley. This is the number, 209-781-0374. That's 209-781-0374. Porterville, folks, is approximately 50 miles northeast of Bakersfield, California. We have an awful lot of listeners in that area. So there's going to be a lot of people attending that lecture. And my lectures are intense. I very seldom give breaks. Make sure you eat a good meal before you before you come. Because I like to get started, and I just go gangbusters overloading you, as a matter of fact, for 6 solid hours. I may give you a break in between there somewhere, but it just depends upon how well I perceive the audience is doing. And to tell you quite frankly, how I feel. If I feel good, I've been known to go 6 to 8 hours without stopping. So might want to bring a sack lunch with you, too, just in case. Okay, that's that. Now, Oklahoma City Day One by Michelle Marie Moore, published by the Harvest Trust. It is a detailed account of the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, April 19, 1995, by Michelle Marie Moore, with a foreword by William Cooper. Officials claim the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building is a simple open-and-shut case, that the bomber was an anti-government extremist exacting revenge with a fertilizer bomb packed inside a Ryder truck, which appears to be the terrorist's rental truck of choice. The media tells us that we must fear American patriots and the militia. Nothing could be farther from the truth. In this monumental work, ladies and gentlemen, over 640 pages in length, encyclopedic in scope, and fully documented, the first of several volumes, you are taken on a journey which begins with the explosions and continues through the final dramatic rescue of the last survivor. The real story of the bombing is a mind-numbing account of federal deceptions, media manipulation, witness intimidation, the deliberate suppression and manufacture of evidence, the cruel exploitation of victims and their family members, attempts to destroy independent investigations, and the government's efforts to conceal the documentation, which actually reveals a foreknowledge of the pending disaster by many federal, state, and local officials who did nothing to stop it and did nothing to warn those who were about to be killed. The true facts of this bombing bear absolutely no resemblance to the official story. The truth is shocking. You must read Oklahoma City Day One, or you will never really know what happened on April 19, 1995. Every single piece of evidence in this book is fully documented and sourced. Complete references are provided. There is an extensive appendix. You will never put this book down until you have finished it. Then you will return to it again and again and again and again. Oklahoma City Day One is but the beginning of a very long story, blood red and born in flames. You can order this book now from a toll-free number, ladies and gentlemen, and you may use credit cards. We need to move this book. We need to get the American people to read it. We need your help. Order not one copy, but 2 or 3 if you can possibly afford it, and make sure that they get into the hands of the right people in your community. Make sure that you call all the bookstores in your community, ladies and gentlemen, and ask them if they are carrying Oklahoma City Day One. If not, ask them to please stock it and give them the address and phone number of the Harvest Trust. And I'm going to give you that right now. It's the Harvest Trust, P.O. Box 1970, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. That's the Harvest Trust, P.O. Box 1970, Eager, Arizona, 85925. The phone number for my secretary, Connie, is 520-333-4578. That's 520-333-4578. Now, if you'd like to order your copy of Oklahoma City Day One, please do it. And please do it now, either through us or through this 800 number. You should also get on every radio talk show throughout the country. Tell them about the book and give out this number where people can get it. It's 1-800-888-9999. That's 1-800-888-9999. All credit cards are accepted, and we've got to get this book out now. The trial has begun, and at least the jury selection is in process. The trial will begin shortly with opening statements. and the American people need to know what has happened. We also need to generate the revenue that we must have in order to publish volume 2 of this 3-volume series. We don't have it now, ladies and gentlemen. We don't even have anything close to it. In fact, the last time I looked at our bank account, it had $88 in it, and that's the truth. And that's the trust bank account, not my personal bank account. Okay? So it's 1-800-888-9999. You may order that book from that number using credit cards. You can order it directly from us with check or money order from the Harvest Trust. The price of the book is, I don't have it right in front of me right now. Oh, brother. Well, I'll give you that tomorrow, or you can just call that number and find out. Again, the book is Oklahoma City Day One by Michelle Marie Moore. The number is 1-800-888-9999. Really easy to remember. Call every talk show that you can find. Tell them about the book. Give out that number where people can get the book. Also, call every single bookstore in your town. Ask them if they're carrying Oklahoma City Day One by Michelle Marie Moore. If they're not, ask them why not. Tell them they better get it, because this book is selling like hotcakes in the stores that it is in, ladies and gentlemen. And if they don't get it, they're going to miss out, and you want it. The book is $34.95 post-paid. $34.95 post-paid. Everybody got that? Okay. All right, that's enough of that. Today we're going to do... it is snowing outside, but I'm not going to do the reruns, like I said, because for some strange reason, we're not having the power outages that we normally have when this kind of weather is taking place. One of the reasons might be is that it doesn't know if it really wants to snow or not. Within the last hour, ladies and gentlemen, it has snowed so hard that we couldn't see 6 feet in front of us. It has snowed on one side of the studio, and the other side was in brilliant sunshine. And I mean on the side it was snowing like cats and dogs. It has it's done some crazy things. But it was supposed to start snowing last night, which it did not. It did not actually start snowing until about an hour and a half ago. And it's snowing on and off. When it snows, it really snows, I got to tell you. And when it's not, it doesn't. It's brilliant sunshine, Arizona-type sunshine. So what I'm going to do is go right through parts 3 and 4 of the occult history of the Third Reich. There's an awful lot here for you to learn, ladies and gentlemen. Remember, Nazis were socialists. That's something the socialists don't want you to know. So they've concocted this big myth, this big lie, this big fabrication, this big tale that the Nazis were right-wing. Folks, the scale measures two extremes. On the left is total control. On the right is absolutely no control whatsoever. And the differing, varying degrees in between. The constitutional republican form of government, which our founding fathers instituted upon this continent for us and our posterity, for them and their posterity, which is us and our posterity, is somewhere in the middle. Socialism is always on the left. Nazis are on the left. All control is on the left, and the farther left you go, the more control you get. That is the truth of the matter. Nazis were socialists. Socialists are Nazis. That's the big scam that they don't want you to know anything about, because what's coming, ladies and gentlemen, are Nazis. You can count on it. So listen to this and make sure you understand it. Also, if you've listened to the Mystery Babylon series that we did, you may have caught the mention in part 2 that the Brotherhood of Templars was founded around the Holy Grail, which is the bloodline of those destined to rule the world. And they also stated that the Nazis had a hatred of the middle class almost as great as their hatred of Jews and communists. That is pure Marxism, ladies and gentlemen. So listen, you're going to hear a lot of parallels and correlation between what happened in Nazi Germany and the occult tradition of the Nazis with what is happening in America today. Make sure that you catch it and understand it, and don't go away. I'll be back when it's finished.
Nazi Germany, a state in which children have become a national obsession. Hitler has proclaimed it must be considered reprehensible to withhold healthy children from the nation. If the fertility of the healthiest bearers of the nationality is consciously and systematically promoted, the result will be a race which has eliminated the germs of our present physical and hence spiritual decay. In the doctrines of National Socialism, this spiritual decay has but one cause, the dilution of the Aryan race by the blood of inferior peoples. Only by breeding from the racially purest can the greatness of the Aryans be restored. In the vanguard of the Nazi racial mission is Hitler's Praetorian Guard, the SS. Before he can enter the SS elite, the candidate must have his German ancestry proved back to the year 1750. Before marriage, the prospective bride of an SS man is subject to rigorous racial investigation. From the offspring of Hitler's guard, many generations in the future is intended to come the racially purest of German stock, a superior breed of human born to rule. The origins of this terrifying vision are strange and contradictory, an unlikely union between the teachings of a modern scientific movement and the esoteric doctrines of the occult. By the late 1920s, the German scientific and medical world had wholeheartedly embraced a new movement, the science of eugenics. The founder of eugenics is an Englishman, Sir Francis Galton, the cousin of Charles Darwin. The aim of eugenics, Galton had written, is to breed out feeble constitutions and petty and ignoble instincts, and to breed in those which are vigorous, noble, and social. To the disciples of eugenics, the intelligent and the industrious, the mentally ill, the criminal, and the alcoholic are so because they carry within them the traits of their parents. The theory is that inferior types, by breeding faster than those of more valuable stock, will produce a catastrophic decline in the quality of the human race. Only by the most drastic measures, it is believed, can disaster be averted. The solution favored by the eugenics movement is the legal control of human breeding. Laws must be passed for the compulsory sterilization of the feeble-minded, the alcoholic, the insane, and the pauper. At the same time, valuable members of society are to be encouraged to have the largest possible number of children. In the 1920s, while eugenics in Europe is still in the realms of scientific theory, in the United States of America, it has long since been put into practice. The state of North Dakota had banned marriage for alcoholics, the insane, and those suffering from tuberculosis as early as the turn of the century. In 1907, the state of Indiana had passed the world's first law allowing sterilization of the mentally ill and criminally insane. By 1930, 28 American states have passed similar laws, and 15,000 people in mental hospitals and prisons have been compulsorily sterilized. By 1939, the figure will have reached 30,000. The Health Office Office of the Government of the German Weimar Republic makes a detailed study of American eugenic laws. It is deeply impressed by America's sterilization campaign, and leading German eugenicists praise U.S. restrictions on the immigration of foreigners and the laws passed in some southern states banning intermarriage between the races. There is a growing concern in German medical circles that Germany is being left behind in the struggle for racial improvement. By 1927, eugenics, now with the new name racial hygiene, is rapidly gaining respectability in Germany. More and more university medical faculties offer courses in the subject. An institute specializing in racial hygiene is founded by the German Health Office. The task of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute is to study means of halting what an influential report had called the physical and mental degeneration of the German people. Racial hygiene has also become a central pillar in the strange ideology of a rising political party. Adolf Hitler had spent much of the year 1924 in prison for his part in an attempted coup against the Bavarian government. While in prison, he'd read a recently published and widely praised textbook on human heredity and racial hygiene. He'd also written his political testament, Mein Kampf. In Mein Kampf, Hitler's commitment to the doctrines of racial hygiene is made clear. The state, he writes, must set race at the center of all life. It must see to it that there is only one distress, to bring children into the world despite one's own sickness and deficiencies. Here, the state must act as guardian of a millennial future, in the face of which the wishes and selfishness of the individual appear as nothing. To Hitler, the millennial future which the state must defend is the coming triumph of Aryan man. The Nazi faith in the destiny of the Aryan race is not the creation of Adolf Hitler. Nor does it spring from the movement for racial hygiene. Its origins lie in the teachings of mystics, clairvoyants, and secret societies dedicated to the occult. In the violent aftermath of the First World War, an increasing fascination with the mystical and the esoteric had swept the German aristocratic and educated classes. So widespread is the influence of mystical doctrines that even one of Germany's most powerful generals believes that national salvation lies in reviving the worship of the Norse god Wotan. General Erich Ludendorff, hero of the Great War and former chief of the German General Staff, freely admits that he believes he is in psychic communion with the Nordic race soul. In 1923, Ludendorff had led an abortive coup in Bavaria. His ally was the little-known political agitator Adolf Hitler. Many of the members of Ludendorff's circle, including his future wife, are closely associated with an influential occultist group calling itself the Eder Society. The Ebba Society was founded in December 1925 by Rudolf John Gorsleben. Some years earlier, Gorsleben had been active in extreme nationalist politics. He had been a speaker at meetings of the occultist Thule Society and had founded a political movement with the anti-Semite Julius Streicher. Streicher would later become a key figure in the infant Nazi party. Gorsleben then abandons politics. He immerses himself in the task of deciphering the ancient Nordic script of the runes and penetrating the secrets of the Icelandic verses known as the Edda. In these, Gorsleben believes can be rediscovered the priceless magical heritage of the vanished Aryan godmen. In widely read periodicals, Gorsleben and the Edda occultists teach that traces of the blood of the Aryans are present in the German people. Warning against racial dilution, Gorsleben writes, "Remember, God dwells within you." It is a creed which will become the lifelong conviction of Heinrich Himmler, Reichsführer of the SS. As a youth, Himmler had avidly consumed the writings of the German occultists. He'd grown obsessed with astrology, spiritualism, and herbalism. Above all, he'd adopted as his own the mystical doctrine of the Aryan. If, as Himmler had come to believe, the blood of the Aryans runs most strongly in the veins of Germanic peoples, then, by breeding from the purest individuals, a race of superhumans could be produced. A race in which the Aryan psychic powers would grow ever stronger. Himmler, trained as an agriculturalist and devoted to the occult, is embarking on the strangest eugenics experiment in history. By 1934, a year after the Nazi seizure of power in Germany, Himmler has firmly established the entry requirements for membership of his SS. The SS Race and Resettlement Bureau investigates the racial ancestry of every applicant. Candidates for membership of Himmler's elite must also submit to a rigorous physical examination. Only those of strongly Nordic appearance, who are free from bodily defects and of good proportion and stature, are accepted. Then begins a year-long process of transformation. Central to the SS man's training is immersion in the cult of the Aryan and the ideology of National Socialism. He must also master the extraordinary set of doctrines enshrined in the SS catechism. It is a catechism in which God is the race. Why do we believe in Germany and the Führer? Because we believe in God. We believe in Germany, which he created, and in the Führer, Adolf Hitler, whom he has sent us. Why do you obey? From inner conviction, from belief in Germany, in the Führer, in the movement, in the SS, and from loyalty. On November the 9th, the anniversary of the coup of 1923, the day symbolized by the rune of remembrance, the SS candidate swears the kith and kin oath. In it, he binds himself and his future family to obey the SS marriage law. None will marry unless the union is approved by the SS Race and Resettlement Bureau. Henceforth, the SS man's family are entitled to wear the coveted badge of SS clan membership, a sunflower bearing the rune of fertility. The strict racial qualifications for SS marriages are widely praised by the scientists and medical men of Germany's racial hygiene movement. Inspired by the example of the SS, measures are already underway to control the breeding of Germany's civilian population. Within months of Hitler's becoming Chancellor of Germany, the first of a series of eugenic laws is passed. The law for the prevention of genetically diseased offspring establishes a vast network of genetic health courts. These have the power to order that individuals suffering from any of a range of mental or physical ailments be sterilized. The campaign is organized on a massive scale. 1,700 genetic health courts will, in 1934 alone, order over 56,000 sterilizations. Within 10 years, almost 400,000 Germans will have been sterilized. In support of the German sterilization campaign, the Reich Health Office and German medical journals published graphic illustrations of the cost to the public of maintaining the mentally and physically handicapped. One poster insists, "We do not stand alone." While a German mother holds her baby, a man holds a shield inscribed with the 1933 sterilization law. Around them are arrayed the flags of nations that have already legalized compulsory sterilization. The second major eugenics law is designed to control the breeding of the population at large. The law for the protection of the genetic health of the German people requires that all those who wish to marry submit to a medical examination. Marriage is totally forbidden to those suffering from diseases believed to be hereditary. The third eugenic measure is passed in the autumn of 1935. Positions of the racial hygiene movement had long argued that intermarriage between the races is genetically harmful, producing degenerate offspring. The law for the protection of German blood and German honor forbids marriage between Jews and non-Jews. Following this new measure, racial hygienists devised complex formulae for calculating the proportions of Jewish blood which each partner can possess if marriage is to be allowed. The massive task of racially investigating all those wishing to marry is entrusted to the SS Race and Resettlement Bureau. Heinrich Himmler's vision of the SS has from the beginning extended far beyond his eugenic project to breed a race of pure-blooded Aryans. His intention was to create a military religious order, an order steeped in Aryan mysticism. Himmler has pronounced, "We assemble and march according to unalterable laws, as a national socialist order of Nordic men, and as a sworn community on our way to a far future." In devising rituals and practices for his Nordic order, Himmler has looked for inspiration to the Teutonic tribes of Germany's distant past. On Himmler's instructions, SS archaeologists from the Race and Resettlement Bureau are intensely researching the history of races they believe to be of Aryan descent. To advise him in his search for the religion of the ancient Teutonic tribes, Himmler has recruited into the SS a renowned Germanic occultist, a man whose claim is to be the last in a long line of Aryan priest kings. Karl Maria Willigut was born in Vienna in 1866. During the Great War, he'd risen to the rank of colonel in the Austrian army. Willigut claims to possess ancestral clairvoyant memory, the power to recall the history and experiences of the Germans over thousands of years. He believes that in himself is an unusually pure strain of the normally latent psychic powers of the Aryans. Willigut's clairvoyant visions have told him that German blood, culture, and history are far more ancient than historians and scientists can know. According to Willigut, the history of the Aryans had begun in 228,000 BC, an era in which there were three suns in the sky, and the world was populated by giants and other fantastic creatures. Willigut's own royal line, He claims to have originated in a union between the gods of air and water in the very earliest days of the earth. Villiger claims that amongst his ancestors are many of the greatest of Germanic heroes. All of Villiger's line through the ages has remained faithful to the occult traditions of the Aryan Germans. Impressed by Villigut's clairvoyant powers, Himmler accepts Villigut into his SS and appoints him head of the Race and Resettlement Bureau's Department of Prehistory. In a remarkably short time, Villigut will rise to the rank of SS Brigadier on Himmler's personal staff. By 1934, Himmler's SS is becoming one of the most powerful organizations in the Reich. Germany's state police forces are, one by one, falling under Himmler's control. The SS is responsible for all intelligence and security duties in the Nazi Party. The SS Race and Resettlement Bureau is dramatically expanding as it polices the National Eugenics Program. The SS is rapidly becoming a state within the Nazi state. Now Heinrich Himmler, with the help of Karl Villigut, plans the strangest of all his creations, an SS spiritual center, an order castle for his Germanic Brotherhood. The castle of Wewelsburg had been built in the early 1600s on the site of a 10th century Saxon fort. Set in the romantic surroundings of Paderborn in Westphalia, Wewelsburg had made a deep impression on Heinrich Himmler. "We have been looking for a castle for our SS for a long time," Himmler confides. "I have found a suitable ruined castle dating back to Germanic prehistory." In late 1934, the SS purchases the sacred site and begins the massive task of reconstruction. Karl Villigut had accompanied Himmler on his earliest visits to the castle. His researches had revealed an ancient prophecy. "Here in writing," reports Villigut, "is the prophecy concerning the great determining battle of which we spoke." Villigut has unearthed the Westphalian legend in which Wewelsburg is destined to become a magical German stronghold in a future conflict between Europe and Asia. The prophecy coincides exactly with Himmler's belief that the SS is to be the bastion of Europe against a massive onslaught from Asia. Already, Himmler's order is preparing for the millennial conflict to come. The SS is to become the most formidable military force in Europe. On December the 14th, 1934, Himmler orders the formation of an SS military detachment, the SSVT. Almost from the outset, the military training of the SSVT is revolutionary. The emphasis is less on the barrack square drill favored by the regular army than on the creation of a new breed of military athlete. In the words of an SSVT commander, "Training is designed to produce a supple and adaptable type of soldier, athletic in bearing, capable of more than ordinary endurance." Unlike the regular army, the SSVT is organized into highly mobile battle groups. It is also the first German military formation to adopt camouflage uniform, and to the astonishment of army commanders, to maneuver with live ammunition. To the SS, casualties in training are simply to be expected. While the SSVT is to become an elite force in the service of the Führer and the Aryan mission, Another arm of the SS is already at war. The SS Death Heads formation is commanded by Theodor Eicher. It accepts without question the Nazi slogan, National Socialism, the expression of our biological knowledge. The task of the Death's Head is to isolate and, if necessary, destroy those it believes infectious germs in the body of the German people. Jews, homosexuals, political dissidents, and social misfits. The means of quarantine is the concentration camp. As the SS Empire spreads its roots deep into the fabric of the Nazi state, Heinrich Himmler, advised by Karl Villiger, continues to develop and refine the rituals of his order. The officer class, envisaged by Himmler as the priests and high priests of the SS, are to be distinguished by the award of special symbols of their place in the hierarchy. At Himmler's personal discretion, members of the SS Corps of Leaders can be awarded the SS Dagger. The dagger is the visible sign of SS nobility and of the favor of the all-powerful Himmler. Irrespective of rank, proven SS men are presented with a silver Death's Head signet ring. The ring is based on a design created for Himmler by Karl Villiger. Its symbols are of deep mystical significance. The Sig Rune, emblem of victory. The Hagal Rune, the rune of hail, destruction, and enclosure. Included is the personal rune group of the Villiger ancestral tradition. And the swastika, symbol of the destiny of Aryan man. In 1937, Himmler decrees that the rings of all dead SS men are to be returned to him for safekeeping in a locked chest deep in the castle of Babelsberg. The return of the ring is a symbol of the dead man's eternal community with the SS Order. The transformation of Himmler's SS castle is by now gaining momentum. Under the architect Hermann Bartels, the west and south wings have been fully renovated. The moat and gardens have been restored and a bridge built leading to the imposing main gates. By 1938, the east wing too has been completely renovated. True to the deeply secretive nature of the SS, Himmler has banned all but the most trustworthy from visiting Babelsberg. Bartels has virtually excluded local companies and labor from the project. Instead, contingents of the Pioneer Corps have been drafted to the region from all over Germany. In the renovation of the castle interior, Himmler spares no expense. Paneling and furnishings, doors and balustrades are all of solid oak. An elaborately carved spiral staircase is built in workshops on the site. Everywhere, there is the finest of decorative wrought ironwork. The chambers of SS leaders, each room named after a Germanic hero, are to be filled with appropriate relics. Arms and armor are collected from all over Germany. Himmler has pronounced, "May the spirit of the most distant past be the future in this castle." By the late 1930s, the National Socialist aim of increasing the population of racially desirable Germans has been given the highest national priority. The means is to remove German women from paid employment and return them to the home. Their task will be to produce the greatest possible number of children. Soon after the foundation of the Nazi state, government loans worth a year's salary are awarded to men whose wives leave their jobs. The amount which must be repaid is reduced for every child the family produces. By 1940, 1,700,000 loans will have been granted. In 1938, a decree is issued requiring that all public officials marry or resign. All couples married for 5 years who are still childless incur a tax penalty. Grounds for divorce are broadened to include the inability of a wife to bear children. Abortion is illegal for those classed as Aryans, but encouraged for non-Aryans. At the instigation of Heinrich Himmler, laws are passed removing all legal obstacles to Aryan women bearing children outside marriage. Himmler has decreed, "Sacred to us is every mother of good blood. Of the greatest value of all are the offspring of his SS elite." In December 1935, Himmler had founded the project which would remain his obsession for almost 10 years. He calls it the Lebensborn, the spring of life. It is a chain of maternity homes and breeding centers for his SS racial elite. In Himmler's words, a nursery garden for pure Germanic blood. In Germany, there will be 10 such homes, each veiled in secrecy and under heavy SS guard. I fostered rumors, Himmler admits, to the effect that every single woman desiring a child could turn to Lebensborn in the strictest confidence. We only recommend genuinely valuable men as procreation helpers. In spite of the stringent racial qualifications required, there is no shortage of prospective mothers. The Nazi League of German Maidens has officially stated, "Although not every German girl can hope to find a husband, you can all become mothers." An SS race and resettlement resolution of 1937 notes, "The Lebensborn will bring them together with a man not casually, but in full awareness that they are fulfilling a noble duty towards the nation." At a naming ceremony, the children of the Lebensborn project are immediately immersed in the Germanic ritual of the SS clan. Males are touched on the forehead with an SS dagger, symbolizing their first initiation into Himmler's mystical order. Mothers of SS children are told, "Remember that you are but a link in the clan's endless chain." For years, Himmler has pondered the question of how his SS order is to be governed. Taking his inspiration from the Knights of the Round Table, Himmler has appointed a shadowy inner council of 12 chosen SS leaders. The ritual setting for their deliberations is the castle of Wabelsburg. In the massive north tower of the castle is an inner sanctum, a vast circular hall, its walls 12 feet thick. Around the chamber stand 12 columns. On the floor is a mosaic of swastikas, forming a sun wheel of 12 radiating spokes. In this strange chamber, Himmler and his chosen 12 commune with the Aryan race soul and the spirits of the Germanic ancestors. Deep below the inner sanctum, cut into the solid bedrock, is the crypt, Valhalla, Here are performed ceremonies of the dead. In the center, the wooden coats of arms of a dead SS knight are to be ceremonially burned. 12 stone plinths around the walls will hold 12 urns, each of which will one day hold the armorial ashes of a departed knight. In the crypt burns an eternal flame, symbol of the continuity of the order and its eternal mission in the service of the race. In 1937, Heinrich Himmler, speaking to senior German army officers, proclaims, "The next 10 years will see a war of annihilation conducted by the subhuman enemies of the entire world against Germany, the kernel of the Teutonic race and guardian of the culture of the human race. It will mean," warns Himmler, "the existence or non-existence of that white race of which we are the leading nation." In reality, the war of racial annihilation foreseen by Himmler will be the war about to be waged by Germany. For Adolf Hitler, the first step in the creation of a greater Germanic empire has been to order, in March 1936, the reoccupation of the demilitarized Rhineland. It is a blatant contravention of the Treaty of Versailles. In the wake of the occupation, the SS becomes deeply involved in the first sterilization campaign to be waged on grounds of race. In a joint operation mounted by the Gestapo and genetic health courts, 500 children of mixed race, the offspring of black French soldiers, are seized and sterilized. It is a grim warning of horrors to come. By now, the racial doctrines of National Socialism have found ardent support far beyond the frontiers of the German Reich. In the United States of America, the German-American Bund, led by Fritz Kuhn, is secretly supported by the German Foreign Office. In Belgium, the ultra-nationalist Rexist Party is founded by Leon de Grel. In Britain, Oswald Mosley and the British fascists ardently support Hitler's New Germany. In Austria, Seyss Inquart, leader of the Austrian National Socialists, is appointed Minister of the Interior in response to German pressure. It is he who, after violence orchestrated by the Austrian SS, invites German forces to enter Austria and restore order. Austria is to become a province of Germany. In the wake of the occupation, SS troops of the Gestapo and SD Security Service arrest 76,000 Austrians and commit them to concentration camps. Next on Hitler's agenda is Czechoslovakia. The leader of the National Socialists in the German-populated region of Czechoslovakia is Konrad Henlein. In the months following the German occupation of Austria, Henlein provokes a crisis in the Sudeten. His followers, armed by Germany and supported by detachments of the SS, begin an uprising that will culminate in Hitler's occupation of Czechoslovakia. As the German army consolidates its hold on Czechoslovakia, Himmler dispatches an SS brigadier to Prague. His mission is to organize the deportation of 6 million Czechs and the resettlement of Czech agricultural lands by racial Germans. In Himmler's plan, the settlers would be selected on grounds of racial purity by his own race and resettlement bureau. Even though Hitler has already spoken favorably of the mass deportation of Czechs, Himmler's plan comes to nothing. The German armaments industry covets Czech factories and labor and will tolerate no disruption. In Poland, Himmler's Aryan vision will encounter no such obstacle. In Mein Kampf, Hitler had written, "We begin where we left off 600 years ago. We put an end to the perpetual Germanic march to the south and west of Europe and turn our eyes towards the lands of the east." In the summer of 1939, Hitler summons Heinrich Himmler to his Bavarian mountain retreat. In the coming invasion of Poland, the SS is to play a key role. It is to ruthlessly eliminate from the Polish population all those who might carry the seeds of a future class of leaders. Under Himmler's head of security, Reinhard Heydrich, five SS Einsatzgruppen extermination squads are to follow close behind the invading German armies. In Poland, Himmler will embark on the first stage of his long-cherished dream. The SS is to be the vanguard of a great Germanic migration. In the invasion of Poland on September the 1st, 1939, the SSVT and Death's Head formations are for the first time thrown into battle. In spite of a lack of experienced leaders, Himmler's hand-picked fighters prove fanatical in the attack, undeterred by heavy casualties. Unlike their army comrades, the SS have been instilled with the knowledge that they are in the service of a great mission. The conquest and enslavement of an inferior race and the foundation of an Aryan empire. While the SS military formations bask in the success of their Polish campaign, Reinhard Heydrich's Einsatzgruppen unleash a reign of terror. Tens of thousands of Poles are seized and shot. The victims are teachers, doctors, officials, aristocrats, Catholic priests, and Jews. Hitler had ordered, "Whatever we find in the shape of an upper class in Poland is to be liquidated." To the horror of regular army commanders, the SS is reveling in its murderous task. By September the 27th, less than a month after the invasion, Heydrich estimates of the Polish upper classes in the occupied territories, only 3% is still present. For his services in the cause of racial conquest, Heinrich Himmler is rewarded by a grateful Führer. On September the 29th, Hitler informs him that he is to be appointed Reichskommissioner for the strengthening of Germanism. The resettlement of occupied territories is to be Himmler's exclusive province. The East is to belong to the SS. The war into which Europe has been plunged is eagerly embraced by a rapidly expanding armed SS. By June 1940, Heinrich Himmler's army, now renamed the Waffen-SS, is a formidable motorized force of 100,000 men. In the Low Countries and France, the new divisions hunger for glory. While the exploits of his military athletes win the grudging respect of the regular army, and in Hitler's words, pay the butcher's bill, Himmler's thoughts are elsewhere. To him, the war in Western Europe is merely a distraction. Only in the East can the destiny of the SS be truly fulfilled. Since early 1939, an SS plan had been in preparation for the repatriation of up to 30 million racial Germans resident in foreign countries. An agreement had been struck with the Soviet Union and the Baltic states for the transfer of their German populations to the Reich. Their actual destination will be Poland. The SS Race and Resettlement Bureau carefully investigates the ancestry of the first wave of migrants, in all, almost 500,000 people. They are presented with Reich citizenship and dispatched to SS transit camps. Their fate, according to Himmler's blueprint for the East, is to become a new Germanic peasantry. Their guardians and rulers are to be the aristocracy of the SS. By mid-1941, 1 million Poles and Polish Jews have been driven from their homes and deported to the area of Poland known as the Government General. The Jewish people of the conquered territories have been forced into ghettos to await a fate as yet unknown. Two 200,000 repatriated Germans have been settled on the seized lands. Yet, resettlement is only the first phase in Himmler's grand design. The second is the repossession of whatever Aryan blood can be found in the Polish population. On Himmler's orders, Poles are to be subject to a massive program of racial screening. Tens of thousands of Polish children are examined by the SS Race and Resettlement Bureau. The shape of the face, eye and hair color, even x-rays of the skull are used by SS physicians to detect traces of Nordic blood. Of those rejected as racially undesirable, many are sterilized. Those deemed of racial value are forcibly taken west. After a period of what the SS term re-Germanization in a Lebensborn home, they are to be adopted by SS families. For Himmler, the seizure of children of Aryan stock is a long-term project. Of more pressing importance is the rapid expansion of the Waffen SS. In Himmler's eyes, traditional ideas of nationality are meaningless. All that matters is race. His aim is the creation of a pan-European brotherhood of the racially pure, an international SS, ready for the coming crusade against the Slavs and Bolshevism. The National Socialist movements of the Nordic countries will prove fertile grounds for recruitment. The Viking Division, composed of Norwegian, Danish, Dutch, and Flemish, is the first of 13 SS divisions to be raised from Nordic or Germanic foreigners. All are formations entirely composed of volunteers. To the members of Himmler's foreign legions, in the racial vision of the SS lies the future of Europe. With the seeds of a pan-European SS army sown in the conquered West, and the battles for the East which Himmler foresees drawing ever closer, the castle of Wewelsburg takes on an even more powerful significance. Wewelsburg, spiritual center of the SS order, is to become a city. The North Tower, with its sacred hall and underground vault, is to be the center point of vast circular grounds. Surrounding them is to be built an enormous complex of administrative centers, libraries, and research institutes for astrology, astronomy, and Teutonic history. Ringing the city will be walls over 40 feet high. Even the ground plan of this, the SS Vatican, is of mystical significance. It represents the head of a spear, its tip pointing to the north. The cost of realizing Himmler's vision is to be 300 million marks, an extraordinary sum. The entire project is to be completed sometime in the 1960s. By then, the SS will possess its own independent state, a state carved from the heartland of the Soviet Union. To Heinrich Himmler, Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of the Soviet Union, promises the fulfillment of all his dreams. With victory will come the foundation of an SS kingdom. With Heinrich Himmler, Grand Master of the SS Order in supreme authority. With SS nobles ruling as the feudal overlords of Germanic settlers, the Order will return to its millennial mission. From the SS peasant warrior, conqueror of the Slavs, will be bred over many generations the next phase in human evolution.
Stay tuned for part 4 of the occult history of the Third Reich and the final episode. Thank you.
1933. All over Germany, Nazi students, brown shirts, and Hitler youth gather and burn books by the thousand. Works of literature, philosophy, and science, believed un-German, are consigned to the flames. Adolf Hitler has declared war on reason itself. People set us down as enemies of intelligence, declares Hitler. We are, but in a much deeper sense than those conceited dolts of bourgeois scientists ever dream of. Hitler's revolt against the intellect is to be enshrined in a new religion, a religion devoted to the mysteries of blood and race. The old beliefs will be brought back to honor again, Hitler declares. The whole secret knowledge of nature, of the divine, of the shapeless, the daemonic. We will wash off the Christian veneer and bring out a religion peculiar to our race. The religion of blood of which Hitler speaks will pave the way to the murder of millions. Yet, the Nazi creed of race is not of Hitler's own creation. Its roots lie in the teachings of Germanic mystics and the doctrines of the occult. In the Germany of the 1890s, there is an overwhelming sense of promise unfulfilled. With the birth of the Second German Reich in 1871 and the crowning of Kaiser Wilhelm I, Germany's future had seemed assured. Yet, the romantic hope for a nation of stability and order had failed to materialize. Behind the medieval ceremony of the Kaiser's court, there is the deep trauma of an industrial revolution. Peasants abandon the land in their millions, flocking to the cities. Artisans and craftsmen find their livelihood swept aside by the onslaught of mass production. A new class of financiers and industrialists vies for power with the ancient aristocracy. Already, the new German Reich seems destined for chaos and division. Ironically, the unity of purpose craved by so many Germans of the Kaiser's Reich will be provided by the teachings of an Englishman. In 1897, Kaiser Wilhelm II summons to his court the renowned English writer Houston Stuart Chamberlain. Chamberlain's book, The Foundations of the 19th Century, will be the inspiration for a generation of German nationalists, anti-Semites, mystics, and the future National Socialist Party. According to Chamberlain, the key to human history lies in the rise and fall of races. Chamberlain idolizes the Teutonic race as the creator of culture and of all true civilization. The German mind, writes Chamberlain, must guide the Aryan peoples to racial supremacy and world domination. Kaiser Wilhelm will later write to Chamberlain, "It was God who sent your book to the German people, and you personally to me." Chamberlain preaches that an affinity with the mystical is rooted deep in the Aryan character. And he writes, "Every mystic is, whether he will it or not, a born anti-Semite." In the Prussia of the late 19th century, Jews remained excluded from the army officer corps, from the judiciary, and from the higher ranks of the civil service. Throughout Europe, such measures had been defended for centuries by questioning the moral qualities and the political loyalties of non-Christians. The writings of Chamberlain will add to European anti-Semitism a new and sinister dimension. Jews will be seen not as a religious community, but as an alien and enemy race. In Chamberlain's racial doctrines, the aim of the Jewish people is to corrupt the blood of the Aryans by racial mixing. The result, he warns, will be physical and moral degeneration and the end of the dream of Aryan world power. The only course, is to purge Germany of Jews and all racial aliens. The key to the German mission, Chamberlain believes, is the creation of a truly Teutonic religion, a religion founded on the sacred mystery of Aryan blood. As Chamberlain's racial doctrine spread throughout Germany, in Austria, a blood religion is already taking shape. By the beginning of the 20th century, the ethnic Germans of Austria have come to see themselves as a people under siege. Once the rulers and administrators of the great Austro-Hungarian Empire, Austrian Germans are now a minority in a state dominated by Slavic peoples. Civil servants are required to speak Czech as well as German. Czech priests have been allocated large numbers of German parishes. German language and culture seem in mortal danger. In the eyes of many Austrian Germans, the Catholic Church appears utterly committed to supporting Slavic interests. The result is widespread hatred for a religion which appears both hostile and treacherous. The profound insecurity of the German people of Austria leads to the growth of a powerful pan-German movement. Its aim is the unification of all Germans in a single fatherland. Amongst the ranks of the new movement are many who, disillusioned with Christianity, believe that the Germans must return to the religion of their ancestors, the worship of the Nordic gods and the primal laws of nature. The doctrine that blood purity will usher in a golden age of German supremacy will find its most powerful expression in the teachings of the renegade Cistercian monk Georg Lanz. Lanz, Grand Master of the Occultist Order of the New Templars, preaches a strange doctrine, a doctrine he names Theozoology. In the distant past, the Atlanteans, the fourth root race of creation, had split into pure and bestial species. After many thousands of years, the pure race, the Aryan godmen of the fifth root race, had interbred with the beasts. The result was catastrophic decline and the near loss of the Aryan psychic powers. Lanz believes that the ancient Germanic tribes had, by imposing strict race laws, purified their blood, retrieving traces of the Aryan's divine nature. Those laws, Lanz teaches, had been destroyed by Christianity and must be revived. The result, over many generations, would be the breeding of a superior type of human, a God-man, destined to rule the world. Cosmopolitan Vienna, with its diverse mixture of peoples and cultures, appalls Georg Lanz. To him, the chaos of the modern world represents a final battle. A battle between the blonde races with their strong traces of Aryan blood and the subhumans, the races whose blood is dominated by that of the beasts. From 1905, Lanz's prescription for racial salvation he publicizes in his own immensely popular journal, Ostara. The Germanic ruling classes, Lanz proposes, the racially purest of all Germans, are to be encouraged to reproduce. Polygamy and a selective human breeding program would serve to reclaim blood purity. As for the lower classes, their poverty indicates racial inferiority, and they must be enslaved or sterilized. Marriages between Germans and inferior races would be illegal and punished by a starvation diet. Jews, the Aryans' deadliest enemies, would be used as beasts of burden, deported to Madagascar, or incinerated. From modest premises in Vienna, Georg Lanz's Ostara is distributed throughout the German-speaking world. In 1909, Lanz is visited by a 20-year-old poverty-stricken painter. Adolf Hitler is in search of back copies. he is anxious to complete his Ostara collection. When Hitler moves to new lodgings, a men's hostel at 27 Meldemannstrasse, he takes his collection of over 50 copies of Ostara with him. Like many of his fellow German Austrians, Hitler had seen the Jews as an alien religion. Now he has learned from the teachings of Jörg Lanz that German and Jew are races at war. Hitler would later write, "I found the racial conglomeration of the imperial capital disgusting. The city seemed the very embodiment of racial infamy." In May 1913, Hitler leaves Vienna for a new life in the German fatherland. The Bavarian city of Munich, in which the 24-year-old Adolf Hitler ekes out a precarious living, seethes with nationalist passion and anti-Semitic agitation. Here, as in Vienna, secret societies and occultist circles proliferate, fueled by the uncertainties of the modern world. To their educated and aristocratic members, the teachings of Jörg Lanz and the German occultists are infinitely reassuring. The forces of democracy and capitalism, hated agents of change, are cast as the sinister inventions of inferior races, above all, of the Jews. There is a widespread longing for war, a war which would herald the return of unity, of hierarchy, and of empire. Jörg Lanz has prophesied, "Amid the jubilation of the liberated God-men, we would conquer the whole planet. The fire should be raked until sparks fly from the barrels of German battleships and order is created." On August the 1st, 1914, in Munich's Odeonplatz, the war eagerly awaited by German nationalists is proclaimed to a jubilant crowd. Amongst the cheering throng is Adolf Hitler. 3 days after the declaration of war, Hitler requests to be allowed to join a Bavarian regiment. "For me," Hitler will declare, "as for every German, there now began the greatest and most unforgettable time of my earthly existence." After 8 weeks of training, Hitler is sent to the front with the 16th Bavarian Infantry Reserve Regiment. His first battle is at Ypres. On Hitler's first day in action, his performance leads to his appointment as a regimental runner, a member of the select band of frontline messengers. The following day, Hitler rescues his deputy commanding officer under fire. The exploit earns him promotion to Lance Corporal and the Iron Cross Second Class. In the 45 months that Hitler's regiment will spend in the front lines and in 36 major battles, Hitler will earn a reputation for immense personal courage. Senior officers are lavish in their praise. One calls him an exceptionally brave, effective, and conscientious soldier. To Hitler's comrades, the dedicated runner they call the Austrian seems aloof and remote. Only when speaking of the new era to come does Hitler reveal a burning passion. After the war, he is convinced Austrian Germans will be reunited with the fatherland, and the new Greater Germany will purge itself of foreign racial elements and the democracy they strive to create. To his comrades, Hitler's arguments are persuasive. Almost no one, a fellow soldier would recall, could withdraw himself from Adolf Hitler's strong personality, and his opinions were accepted by most of us. In the summer of 1918, Hitler is awarded the Iron Cross First Class for his outstanding combat performance in almost 4 years at the front. It is a decoration seldom awarded to a soldier of such lowly rank. On October the 13th at Ypres, only 4 miles from where he'd seen his first action in 1914, Hitler is caught in a gas attack. Almost blind, he is taken to a military hospital in Germany. while Adolf Hitler slowly recovers from his wounds, events in the outside world move with dizzying speed. A massive Allied offensive threatens to break through German lines. On the home front, Berlin has been paralyzed by strikers demanding peace and democracy. The Kaiser is advised that in the interests of the Fatherland, he should sue for peace and concede democratic government. On November the 9th, with Berlin in the grip of a general strike, the Kaiser abdicates. The Second German Reich has come to an abrupt and traumatic end. As Germany plunges into anarchy, Adolf Hitler, still a serving soldier, returns to duty. First to his regiment in Munich, then as a guard at a prisoner of war camp 60 miles from the city. While his prisoners await repatriation, Hitler broods on the treachery of the armistice. To him, as to many of his comrades, the German army and people have been stabbed in the back by Democrats, Marxists, and above all, by Jews. "The hatred grew in me," Hitler writes. "Hatred for those responsible for this deed. My own fate became known to me. I decided to go into politics." Between March 1919, when Hitler returns to his unit in Munich, and March 1920, when he is finally discharged from the army, both Hitler and Bavaria will have been transformed. While Bavaria becomes first a Soviet republic, then a haven for nationalist counter-revolutionaries, Adolf Hitler becomes an army spy, joins the insignificant German Workers' Party, and discovers his gift for oratory. While still in the pay of the Bavarian army, Hitler becomes the party's chief of propaganda. Hitler's constant theme is the removal of Jews from German life. From Jörg Lanz, Hitler had learned that the aim of the Jewish race is to sabotage the Aryan world mission. It is a doctrine already familiar to many members of the German Workers' Party. The party itself had been conceived by the Thule Society, the Munich Lodge of the occultist German order. The symbol of the Thule Society is the swastika. The party, renamed the National Socialist German Workers' Party, has yet to develop a fully fledged ideology. The molding of Hitler's racial beliefs into a coherent and all-embracing worldview will result from his close friendship with three men: Alfred Rosenberg, disciple of Houston Stuart Chamberlain; Dietrich Eckart, intimate associate of the Thule Society; and Rudolf Hess, future deputy Führer of the Nazi Party. All are convinced mystics. Alfred Rosenberg, a Baltic German, had discovered Chamberlain's foundations of the 19th century when he was only 17 years old. Personal experience of the Russian Revolution and the ensuing civil war seems to Rosenberg to confirm Chamberlain's racial doctrines. The ruling aristocracy of Russia, whom Rosenberg believes to be of Aryan stock, had been displaced by the inferior Slavic masses, roused and led by Jews. To Rosenberg, Bolshevism in Russia and the new democracy in Germany are part of the same worldwide Jewish conspiracy. His inspiration is a mysterious work known as The Protocols of the Elders of Zion. First brought to Germany by waves of Russian emigres fleeing the revolution, the Protocols purports to be a secret Jewish blueprint for world domination. In reality, it is a 19th century forgery perpetrated by the secret police of the Russian Tsar. In Munich, Alfred Rosenberg seeks out the well-known anti-Semitic journalist, publisher, and poet Dietrich Eckart. It is Eckart who introduces Rosenberg to Adolf Hitler. Between 1920 and 1923, Eckart and Rosenberg will labor tirelessly in the service of Hitler and the party. Through Rosenberg, Hitler learns of the protocols and the works of Houston Stuart Chamberlain. Rosenberg speaks at the Thule Society meetings and edits the Völkischer Beobachter, the party newspaper originally owned by Thule. In the pages of the Beobachter, Rosenberg will publish the serialized text of the protocols of the Elders of Zion. It is to raise funds for the party newspaper that Dietrich Eckart introduces Hitler to the influential circles that will increasingly support the fledgling Nazi party. It is while staying in the Berlin house of a wealthy manufacturer that Hitler is given instruction in public speaking by a well-known teacher of drama. Dietrich Eckart had introduced Hitler to his powerful friends as Germany's young messiah. Eckart will also lead to Hitler the first of his followers to believe that description to be the literal truth. Rudolf Hess is, like Hitler himself, a disillusioned and embittered war hero. In May 1920, Hess had been taken by Eckart to his first Nazi Party meeting and his first encounter with Adolf Hitler. In Hitler, Hess had, he believed, found the savior long prophesied in German occultist circles. The Stark von Oben, the strong one from above. The man who would lead the Germanic peoples to the dawn of an Aryan millennium. By 1923, much of Hitler's racial ideology has taken shape. The prejudices of his youth have been forged into a doctrine steeped in Aryan mysticism. His faith in his Germanic mission is deepening. Now, after attending a nationalist rally near Bayreuth, Hitler makes a personal pilgrimage. At Bayreuth is the house in which Richard Wagner, Hitler's boyhood idol, had spent the last years of his life. The house, still the Wagner family home, had become a virtual shrine. As a young man, Hitler had worshipped Wagner as the supreme prophet of the German people. In Wagner's operas and in his anti-Semitic writings, Hitler now sees the highest confirmation of his own innermost convictions. In common with the Germanic mystics, Wagner had believed the Jews to be incapable of true spirituality. While the rest of humanity had descended from higher beings, the Jews were descendants of the apes. In Wagner's mystical drama, Parsifal, based on medieval tales of the Knights of the Holy Grail, Parsifal is an Aryan Christ. Wagner had himself described the Grail as a symbol of blood purity, a warning to the German people against racial pollution. After a tour of the Wagner home, Hitler asks permission to visit the composer's tomb alone. He returns in a state of great emotion to declare, "Out of Parsifal, I make a religion." Wagner's daughter, Eva, had married the English mystic Houston Stuart Chamberlain. Chamberlain tells Hitler, "With one stroke, you have changed the state of my soul. That Germany gives birth to a Hitler in the time of her greatest need is proof of her vitality." In a little over a month after his visit to Bayreuth, Hitler launches his first bid for national power. The attempted coup of November the 9th, 1923, in which Hitler's brown shirts, along with other nationalist paramilitary groups, attempt to take control of the Bavarian government, is a disastrous failure. Yet, Hitler's arrest, his trial, and his subsequent imprisonment will make of the obscure Austrian agitator a household name and a political martyr. It is in the prison fortress of Landsberg that Hitler's beliefs, founded in a mystical faith in the destiny of the German race, take on a new and scientific character. Hitler's fellow prisoner, Rudolf Hess, had been for a time a student of economics at the University of Munich. There, he'd been strongly influenced by the teachings of the ex-general and geopolitician Karl Haushofer. By detailed study of populations and natural resources, the new science of geopolitics attempts to explain the political history of nations. Haushofer had taught that Germany's needs would best be satisfied not by the capture of overseas colonies, but by expansion on the European continent itself. To Haushofer, Germany's national destiny lies to the east. The doctrine of Lebensraum, the German right to living space, will become a cornerstone of national socialist ideology. It will be a doctrine surpassed in importance only by the creed of rest. While Hitler languishes in Landsberg, he learns of the international scientific movement known as eugenics. The concern of eugenics is that the human race faces imminent degeneration and decline. Inspired by Darwin's theory of evolution, eugenicists believe that not only diseases such as tuberculosis and epilepsy are passed from generation to generation, but also mental and moral strengths and weaknesses. Many are also convinced that interbreeding between the races produces degenerate offspring. Because more children are produced by the lower classes than by their social superiors, many eminent scientists and physicians fear a future racial disaster. To avoid calamity, they argue that valuable individuals should be encouraged to breed, while those of inferior stock must be sterilized in the interest of the greater good. From England, its country of origin, eugenics had spread to Germany, becoming known as racial hygiene. In 1923, Fritz Lenz had been appointed Germany's first professor of racial hygiene at the University of Munich. Lenz is the co-author of an influential textbook, The Outline of Human Genetics and Racial Hygiene, a book closely studied by the imprisoned Adolf Hitler. In it he finds the scientific counterpart of the occultist mystical quest for racial aristocracy. Fritz Lenz argues that between races and between individuals there is a clear hierarchy. While some are destined only to be slaves, others are born to rule. Having served 9 months of his 5-year sentence, Hitler is released from Landsberg in December 1924. His imprisonment had been, in his own words, a university at the expense of the state. In Landsberg, the strands of Hitler's ideology had been woven into his personal political testament, Mein Kampf. In Mein Kampf, Hitler describes the purpose of the state which the party will construct. A state, he writes, is only a means to an end. And its end it sees as the preservation of the racial existence of men. It feels the obligation, in accordance with the eternal will that dominates this universe, to promote the victory of the better and stronger, and to demand the submission of the worse and weaker. All science, all art, even human reason itself must, Hitler believes, serve the will of nature. And nature, he insists, is fundamentally aristocratic. Having learned from the failure of the Nazi coup in 1923, Hitler commits the Nazi Party to the pursuit of power by democratic means. Meanwhile, he constructs a shadow state. It is to be founded on the strictly hierarchical principles, long advocated by German mystics, and now supported by the ideas of racial hygiene. In every sphere of life, there is to be a leader, a Führer, with absolute power to govern his subordinates. Each Führer owes unquestioning obedience to his own leader. At the summit of the Nazi hierarchy is Adolf Hitler, the supreme Führer, the authority from which all power flows. In the mystical ideology of National Socialism, the Fuhrer has been chosen by the very laws of nature. He is the highest expression of the soul of the West. To Hitler, the task of the supreme leader, his only mission is to unlock the emotions of the German masses, to bring to the surface their latent faith in race and love.
Denn als unsere Partei gerade 7 Mann hoch war, sprach sie schon 3 Grundsätze aus. Erstens, sie wollte eine wahrhaftige Selbst- und Volkspartei sein. Und zweitens, sie wollte daher kompromisslos die einzige Macht und alleinige Macht in Deutschland. Und weil dieser beste Rassenwert der deutschen Nation in einer stolzen Selbsteinschätzung mutig und kühn die Führung des Reiches und Volkes fordere, der sich als Träger seines besten Blutes fühlen und dieses Wissen zur Führung der Nation erhoben hat und entschlossen ist, diese Führung zu behalten, wahrzunehmen und nicht erst abzugeben. Die Partei wird für alle Zukunft die politische Führungsauslese des deutschen Volkes sein. Vielmehr in ihrer Lehre unveränderlich, in ihrer Organisation stahlhart, in ihrer Taktik mühsam und anpassungsfähig, im Gesamtbild aber wie ein Orden sein. Es ist unser Wunsch und Wille, dass dieser Staat und dieses Reich bestehen sollen in den kommenden Jahrtausenden. Wir können glücklich sein zu wissen, dass diese Zukunft rechtlos uns gehört.
Of Adolf Hitler is to many physicians and scientists of the racial hygiene movement a triumph for science. The Eugenics Journal, edited by the racial hygienist Fritz Lenz, celebrates what it calls a new age of racial biological revolution. Lenz writes, "It is the will of the Fuhrer that the demands of racial hygiene should be put into practice without delay. It is the beginning of a road that will lead to mass sterilization, murder, and genocide." On July 14, 1933, the Nazi government passes the law for the prevention of genetically diseased offspring. The law allows compulsory sterilization of those suffering from a wide range of physical and mental illnesses believed hereditary. Genetic health courts set up to administer the law will order the sterilization of almost 400,000 people. The most common grounds will be feeble-mindedness, schizophrenia, epilepsy, and alcoholism. With the cooperation of the German medical profession, the German people are to be purged of all hereditary weakness. The Nazi eugenics program has yet to concern itself with the quest for racial purity, but already the groundwork has been laid. In March 1933, the SA and the SS had enforced a boycott of Jewish businesses. In April, all Jews are barred by law from posts in the German civil service and judiciary. A measure preventing Jews from teaching in universities soon follows. The intention is to exclude Jews from German cultural and economic life. In September 1935, the eugenics program is extended to biologically isolate the Jewish people. From the Germanic mystics, Hitler has absorbed a distinctive and terrifying theory of the nature of the Jews. The Jew, he states, is the anti-man, the creature of another god. He must come from another root of the human race. The law for the protection of German blood and German honor forbids marriage between those classed as Aryans and those deemed to be Jews. It is a measure demanded since the turn of the century by Germanic occultists. The definition of who and who is not a Jew has been provided by the scientists of the racial hygiene movement. By late 1935, the key elements of the Nazi eugenics program are in place. The sterilization campaign is underway. The race laws protecting German blood from racial pollution are being vigorously enforced. Even marriages between those classed as Aryans are now subject to strict controls, with both partners being investigated for hereditary diseases. Plans for the next stage in Hitler's campaign to improve the German racial stock are already being prepared. Hitler had announced to a Nazi party rally, if Germany was to get 1 million children a year and was to remove 700,000 to 800,000 of the weakest people, the final result might even be an increase in strength. At Nuremberg in 1935, Hitler, speaking to the Reich medical Führer, Gerhard Wagner, informs him that in the event of war, he would take up the question of euthanasia and enforce it. In wartime, Hitler believes opposition from the Christian churches could be more easily contained. In reality, by early 1939, the National Socialist state is so secure that no further delay is necessary. In May, Hitler asks his personal physician, Karl Brandt, to appoint an advisory committee to devise a program for the killing of disabled children. To guarantee the maximum secrecy, Hitler's private chancellery is to administer the program. Attempts have already been made to ensure that the German people will, in time, accept Nazi eugenic measures. In school mathematics tests, children are asked to calculate the cost of the mentally ill and handicapped. One states, the construction of an insane asylum requires 6 million Reichsmarks. How many housing units can be built for the amount spent on insane asylums? On August the 18th, Hitler's chancellery issues a circular to all state governments. Children up to the age of 3 who are retarded or deformed must be registered by midwives or physicians, and a questionnaire completed describing their disability. 3 physicians assess the return forms, marking with a plus if the child is to die and a minus if it is to live. No children are actually examined by the physicians. At over 30 special clinics, the selected children are killed by lethal injection, by all drugs, or by starvation. The deaths are explained as resulting from natural causes. Within 2 years, the child killing program will include children up to the age of 12. Man is becoming God, pronounces Adolf Hitler. Those who see in National Socialism nothing more than a political movement know scarcely anything of it. It is more even than a religion. It is the will to create mankind anew. While the German medical establishment wholeheartedly commits itself to purging German racial stock of inferior strains, the task of breeding for strength is already underway. Each member of the SS is carefully selected for his physical perfection and the purity of his blood. Bound by solemn oaths and mystic rituals, SS men may marry only those of proven Germanic ancestry, ensuring that over generations, the SS becomes a reservoir of the purest Aryan blood. The SS clan is a racial aristocracy in the making, a clan whose mission is to rule the East. In September 1939, Hitler unleashes his armies on Poland. 7 years earlier, he had made his objectives clear. Our great experimental field is the East. There, a new European social order will arise. The Polish peasants are to be dispossessed. In their place are to be installed purebred Germans, selected and in time ruled by the SS. Poles from areas annexed by Germany are concentrated in a reservation known as the Government General. Polish children deemed to have Aryan blood are kidnapped and taken to Germany as racially valuable stock. The Jews of the occupied territories are concentrated in city ghettos inside the Government General. The SS Einsatzgruppen special action groups have orders to murder the most educated and influential sectors of the Polish population. They have also been instructed to open the next phase in the Nazi euthanasia program, the killing of those judged unfit for either breeding or labor. In Poland and in regions of Germany near the Polish border, thousands of inmates of psychiatric hospitals are taken and shot. Hitler's Chancellery, guided by its team of medical advisors, has carefully considered the question of how many are to be killed in the German euthanasia campaign. It had been concluded that of every 1,000 people in the German population, 10 are mentally ill. 5 will enter a psychiatric hospital. Of these 5, 1 must die. The number to be killed is calculated by the committee as between 65 and 75,000 people. The method is to be gassing in purpose-built chambers, a procedure suggested by the forensic department of the civil police. The Chancellery unit responsible for the euthanasia program is based at No. 4 Tiergartenstrasse. After its address, the unit will become known as T4. During the German conquest of Western Europe in the summer of 1940, rumors of mysterious deaths in German psychiatric hospitals grow amongst the German public. Increasingly, elderly men and women refuse to enter retirement homes, fearing for their lives. And the T4 program is widening. The residents of TB hospitals and workhouses will soon be included along with the mentally ill prisoners. In early 1941, the Reich Interior Ministry orders that all Jewish patients in German psychiatric hospitals be killed. The murders will be T4's first contribution to Hitler's coming campaign of racial annihilation. The campaign soon to be known as the Final Solution. In 1934, Hitler had described the crusade which he would launch against the Slavic peoples of the Soviet Union. We cannot in any way evade the final battle between German race ideals and Slav mass ideals. We shall take this struggle upon us. It will open the door to permanent mastery of the world. The name chosen for the invasion of Russia is Operation Barbarossa. In medieval legends, revived by the Germanic occultists, the Emperor Barbarossa, who lies sleeping beneath a mountain, would one day awake, unleashing German power in a fury of conquest. For the Slavic peoples of Russia, Adolf Hitler plans a nightmare world of mass slavery and the harshest of eugenic measures. Hitler had insisted, "We are obliged to depopulate as part of our mission of preserving the German people. We shall have to develop a technique for depopulation." Preparing for a future in which tens of millions of Slavs are to be sterilized, German physicians will attempt to develop X-ray and surgical techniques for a mass eugenics program in the East. For Soviet Jews, however, Hitler will countenance nothing short of extinction. The war in Russia is to provide the cover for race murder on an unimaginable scale. On October the 10th, 1941, Field Marshal von Reichenau tells the army divisions under his command, "In the Eastern Sphere, the soldier is not simply a fighter according to the rules of war, but the supporter of a ruthless racial ideology. For this reason, soldiers must show full understanding of the necessity for the severe but just atonement required of the Jewish subhumans." Assigned to each army group is an SS Einsatzgruppe Special Action Unit. The Einsatzgruppen are responsible only to Heinrich Himmler, Reichsfuhrer of the SS. At the outset of Operation Barbarossa, Himmler had confided, "The Führer has ordered the final solution of the Jewish question, and we, the SS, must carry out this order." Himmler's reasoning is the terrifying blend of mysticism and science, now the hallmark of Nazi ideology. "The Jews are the eternal enemies of the German race, and they must be exterminated. If we now fail to destroy the biological basis of Jewry, then one day the Jews will destroy the German people." The murder method adopted for the final solution in the East is mass shooting. By the autumn of 1941, Jews from Germany, Austria, and Czechoslovakia are being deported to the killing grounds of the Soviet Union. The sheer scale of the murder campaign in the East and Himmler's personal distaste for mass shootings prompts him to order a search for an alternative.
And of course, ladies and gentlemen, you know the rest of the story. What is happening in the United States of America and around the world is the same exact thing that brought Hitler to power. Good night, and God bless each and every single one of you. This is the Voice of Freedom. listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network, broadcasting on satellite GE1, transponder 7, 7.56 audio, and over 700 FM stations across the nation and around the world.
This is my daddy's station. I'm Pooh, classic radio like you always wished it could be, 101.1 FM, eager.
101.1 FM is owned and operated by the Independence Foundation Trust as a non-profit community service.
We now return you to our regularly scheduled programming, all oldies most of the time.